Okay, good morning. How's everybody doing? I'm going to try to figure this out. Let's see, is that just as simple as... There we go. Let me go backwards. There we go. All right, again, so my name is Mike Carnathan. I'm a researcher with the Atlanta Regional Commission, and I'm director of Neighborhood Nexus. And Neighborhood Nexus is a community intelligence system that just has loads and loads and loads of data. So it has data of, you know, somewhere around 1,000 variables, all the way down to the neighborhood level, up to county, state, even national data. And that's why I'm here today, because my friends at the GBPI know that if they invite me to things, or especially if they invite me to speak at things, I'm going to bring a big bucket of data. And so now I'm going to share some of the data in this bucket with you guys. But the point is, you know, today, the basic theme is trying to craft an economy that works for everyone. And so what I'm going to be talking about today is the changing definition of everyone. And so what you're going to be, so as I go through these slides, and we go into day, be thinking about how the changing demographics really affects some of the policy areas that you guys are, that hold near and dear. So how is an aging society going to affect how we fund safety net programs? How is the changing faces of our children going to affect public education? How is the changing socioeconomics going to change the way we fund things? So those are just some of the questions we're going to be thinking of. And again, I have lots and lots of data, charts, maps, and graphs. And so if you like data, charts, maps, and graphs, you're in the right place. If you don't, blame Tim Sweeney because he invited me. So this is the way it works. If you like it, I get the kudos. If you don't like it, he gets the blame. So it works out great for me. All right, but before we get into all that, I just want to give you a quick little test. How well do you know Georgia? I'm figuring I'm standing in a room with the smartest people in all of Georgia. Okay, so I'm going to test that. I'm going to put that to the test. I'm going to ask you some simple questions, and all you have to do is just blurt it out. And there's no prizes, so don't get too excited. All right, so we're going to start with an easy one. Which county in Georgia has the most people? There you go. So this is the top 10 right there. So you'll see it's mostly in Metro Atlanta and then other metropolitan areas, but it is Fulton County, 920,000 people in 2010, probably pushing 1 million today. Now the questions are going to get a lot harder. Which county in Georgia has the highest concentration of kids? So this is the highest percentage of kids under 5. Okay, well, we're going to give you a hint. So here's the top 10, and you'll see it's mostly kind of clustered. There's some in the Atlanta region, but a lot clustered down there, and it's actually Liberty County. 10% of the population down there is under 5. Okay, so nobody got Liberty, right? Which county has the highest rate of food stamp usage, a proxy for poverty? I'll give you a hint. Here's the top 10. They're all clustered down in sort of South Georgia. It's actually Terrell County, where about 40% of residents there are on food stamps. All right. So which county has the highest concentration of adults with limited English proficiency? It's another tough one. Here's the spread, and this is kind of spread all over the place. So you'll see up in Dalton and Whitfield County, you'll see some in metropolitan Atlanta, Gwinnett and Hall County, Clayton. But the one with the most is actually Eccles County, way down south. And this is a very high, heavy migrant worker community. And so almost 17% of adults there struggle with the English language. Which county has the highest concentration of those age 16 to 19 who have dropped out of school? So this is an at-risk factor that's associated with lots of other challenging socioeconomics. Again, here's the spread. It's mostly concentrated in South Georgia, but it's Hancock County, which is right there. 34% of kids 16 to 19 are dropped out of school. Which county has the highest concentration of those without health insurance? Something near and dear to Tim Sweeney's heart. Here's the spread. Again, it's north, middle, and south. But it's Eccles County. Now, remember a couple slides ago when I said about limited English proficiency, foreign-born population, migrant workers? There's a relationship there. And that's why, you know, I bring big buckets of data with me, because you never know these sort of relationships that exist. Now, education, income, yeah, we know that. But there's all these other things that are, that everything is interrelated to everything else. And that's something to keep in mind as we start tackling some of these really thorny issues and policies. And finally, which county has the highest teen birth rate? Again, hard question. Again, mostly, now, you know, we've made great progress on teen pregnancy and teen births over the last two decades, but there are still some counties struggling with it, and it's actually Tolliver County, right up there. Okay, so that was mediocre. But those are hard questions. And the point really wasn't to test your knowledge on this, because those are very, very hard questions. The point is to exercise our brains, to really start thinking about this data-driven process to tackling some of these really hard challenges that we have. Things like poverty, things like the struggling middle class, income inequality, social equity. All of these challenges are influenced and influence just a whole concentration of factors. And as part of a larger system. And so when we talk about data, bringing data to the table, bringing, you know, big buckets of data, we need to ensure that the data can speak to the system. And so we can understand all these factors that interplay with one another. And that's something that ARC, Neighborhood Nexus, and myself are personally committed to, is to trying to help, you know, guide us through that data-driven process. Okay, so I'll get off my soapbox now. So what are we talking about today? We're not talking about football. This is SEC country, so we don't talk about mid-major conferences here. What we are talking about is the fact that this is a fast-growing state and a fast-growing region. I think all of you guys know that. But the way we're growing is, you know, we're growing older, but we're still staying young. And so, you know, we're getting a lot more older folks, a lot more younger folks, and that's kind of squeezing the middle a little bit, which has some pretty big ramifications for how we fund public services. Growing more diverse, and I think you guys know that too, but that diversity is really concentrated in the younger age cohorts, and we're going to talk a lot about that. The job markets are recovering, and actually recovering pretty nicely. However, the incomes are not recovering, and that's obviously a challenge. The economy of the future will reflect these changing demographics. So as we age, think about the healthcare sector becoming more important in our economy. New economy jobs are hot. These new economy jobs overwhelmingly require at least a bachelor's degree. But you know, old economy jobs are hot in this state too. And so one of the front lines, one of the battlegrounds we have, is trying to figure out that balance between, you know, high school, vocational education, technical colleges, and just getting, you know, making the economy work for everyone. Because right now, the most educated are winning. And those stuck in the middle are not. So that's what we're going to talk about. But again, before we do it, I want to talk about two big trends. And I'll cue up the video in just a little bit. This is a little video. So one of the two, so we want to talk about big trends that are shaping society. We can go back 200 plus years and look at the fact that, number one, we're living longer, and number two, we're having fewer kids. So what we have here is starting in, starting right here in 1800s, United States, each woman has about 7 kids, and life expectancy was about 40. Now, going forward, you'll see some big changes here. Here comes the Civil War. Oh, life expectancy dropped. We keep going. We're having fewer kids. Here's the Industrial Revolution, and conditions start improving. Life expectancy starts rising. Oh, there's the Spanish influenza. Okay, we're still having fewer kids, still living longer. Fewer kids, living longer. Here comes World War II. Here comes the baby boom. Look, we're having more kids, having more kids, having more kids. Baby boom is over. Having fewer kids, living longer, fewer kids, living longer, fewer kids, living longer, And here we are in 2012. We have an average life expectancy of 79, and we're having 1.9 kids per woman. Now, 1.9 is a big number because that's below replacement rate. All right, so you look at the different races and ethnicities and their fertility trends. You'll see the whites, non-Hispanic, Asian, black, all are under that replacement rate level. And there's some goofy little line. All right, so now what we're going to start looking at is the demographics of our residents. Looking at it, how it's been recently, what it looks like today, and maybe a little glimpse into the future. All right, so now, when I said that, you know, we're a fast-growing state, well, we've been doubling the rate of growth for the nation since 1990, and we've kept that pace up since 2010. So Georgia's a fast-growing state, and in fact, if you look at it, we've added the fourth most people since 1990, behind only California, Texas, and Florida. And metropolitan Atlanta has been a beneficiary of that growth. For those of us geographically challenged, there is metropolitan Atlanta. The blues represent the most growth, and you know, depending on the numbers you look at, metropolitan Atlanta ranks somewhere between 5th and 7th in the number of population, the number of people added since 2010. And this is coming after a decade where metropolitan Atlanta was one of 3 metro areas to add more than 1 million people. And so, you know, that fast growth that we've been accustomed to is continuing. Now, here's another video. And so this is, you know, because everyone likes to see things move around. And so here we're going to look at how the state population has changed since 1900. Okay, so go ahead and start the video. Okay, so today, Georgia is the 8th largest state. But in 1900, we're sort of in the middle of the pack, and we're going to see how this has changed. And we're off. So you'll see, you know, New York, Pennsylvania, you know, those Rust Belt, Northeastern, Midwestern states were very, very powerful. But then there's a big migration out west. Oil was founded. California starts taking off. Oh, and here comes air conditioning. So all of a sudden, people start moving to the south because it's no longer... because you can actually bear it. And so here we go out in here. Now remember, today Georgia was 8th largest. By 2050, we're thinking that Georgia's going to be the 6th largest state. I'm going to stop the video here and move on. The forecast in terms of going back into Georgia and looking where we think the population is going to be growing the most, well, there's metropolitan Atlanta. You know, that's just a big old purple blob. And that's what we're looking at. So purples and blues represent the most population added. And so you'll see metropolitan Atlanta and the other metropolitan areas, Dalton, Columbus, Macon, Savannah, Brunswick, that's where we're thinking that the most population is going to move to. Now, looking at the type of growth and the type of people we have, Georgia is younger than the nation. So we have a smaller percentage of those 18 and older. We have our larger percentage of those 18 and under, and a smaller percentage of those 65 and older. And again, metropolitan Atlanta in particular, again, it's right here, in particular is a young state. So those blues represent the highest percentages of population less than 20. And so you'll see metropolitan Atlanta is a big blue dot there. And if you look at the rest of the southeast, it really stands out. So in particular, we're young compared to the southeast. And here's sort of the way it's spread out throughout the state. Blues represent the oldest areas. Red represents the youngest areas. And so you'll see the North Georgia mountains, a lot of retirement communities there around Lake Oconee, the coastal stuff. And so not only are we diverse, you know, racially and ethnically, we're also very diverse in terms of age. We have lots of pockets of older adults and lots of pockets of kids. Now, it's the interplay between race and age that is particularly fascinating. This is a national forecast. This also applies to Georgia, and we're going to get more into that in a little bit. So if you look at the big blue bars, they represent the population as of today. And then the orange bars represent the expected growth. The first little column over here is the white population. And so you'll see we're expecting losses, losses, losses. The only area that we're going to add more white population is the 65 and older. Okay, so that's this aging of society. This is the aging of the baby boomers. The only places that we're really adding population is going to be in the really the non-black and non-white populations represented here and here. And so this is a trend that we've seen occurring recently, and this is a trend that's going to continue into the foreseeable future. Now, here's one of my, I love making these really complicated charts that you can't make any sense out of. But here's this example. So what this is looking at, all the colors represent, you know, what the big bar represents total growth since 2010, and the colors represent, the blues represent white population change, and then the rest of the bars represent non-white population change. And so what you'll see is a lot of blue bars going this way, which means that they're losing white population, right? And so you look at Georgia, you'll see almost no white growth whatsoever. All the population that we've added, essentially, since 2010 has come from the non-white populations. And that's a common thread in the way our demographics are changing. So, again, focusing in on metropolitan Atlanta, I get the question, I've been getting this question for years and years and years since we first started talking about the diversification of our population. It's like, okay, well, when is metropolitan Atlanta going to be majority-minority? Well, it's happened. So we're here. So it happened sometime last year. So you can stop asking me that question. 49% of the population is white, 51% is non-white. Now, as we move forward in 10, 15, 20 years, we're going to be moving closer down to the Houston profile rather than moving up more towards the Boston or Philadelphia profile. So if you want to see kind of the racial breakdown of Atlanta in 30, 40 years, look at what Houston is today. It's going to be closer to that. That was exciting. This is something called a diversity index. And so I'm going to continue to beat this horse a little bit. And what the diversity index is, and of course it's a really complicated way to communicate a very simple message. The diversity index looks at 100 means that you have perfect diversity, you have equal population in each of the six racial groups. A score of 0 means you have all your population in one racial group. So the higher the score, the more diverse this particular county is. And the reason I wanted to highlight this is because you'll look at Georgia, and you'll see a lot of counties that are red, which means, you know, very diverse counties. And you'll look at North Carolina, you'll see the kind of the same thing. Now, remember back a couple slides ago when I was showing you about population change, you know, Georgia and North Carolina are the ones that are adding population. They also happen to be the most, you know, have the most diversity in the Southeast. And in fact, Gwinnett County right there and Stewart County right there are the two most diverse counties in this extent that you're looking at. So now, back to that interplay of, you know, of age and race. You know, we talk a lot about millennials. We've talked a lot about boomers. Of course, the Gen Xers, me, we don't ever get talked about. We had a movie or two in the 90s, and that was about all we got. But the reason we're talking about millennials so much is because the millennials actually outnumber baby boomers now, okay? And this is the Atlanta region. So there's more millennials than baby boomers. And this is a point that I really want to stress, is that the diversity is concentrated in these younger age cohorts, okay? So you'll look at the 0 to 14 population. We don't have a name for them yet. I think somebody's been calling them founders. I don't understand that. As soon as they start buying stuff, we'll come up with a good name for them. But 60%, 61% of that population is non-white. And almost 60% of the millennials are non-white. And then you have the Gen Xers, the forgotten generation. Majority of the Gen Xers are non-white. Not until you get into the boomers and then the Eisenhowers, the silent generation, whatever you want to call it, before you see, you know, that majority white. So when I'm saying that we're getting old but yet remaining young, that's what we're talking about. And that diversity is really concentrated in that younger age cohort. So what does that mean for public education? What kind of ramifications does that have? For housing. And so this trend that I've just described is going to continue. It's a very, again, another just wild chart that I like to throw at you just to make sure you're awake. But in 1990, we were essentially a bi-ethnic place. White, black, majority white. By 2040, we're going to be more of a marble cake of races and ethnicities, and actually these labels that we have probably won't even apply then. Okay, so now, before we get into some really fun socioeconomic stuff, I want to take a quick look at just the families, because really what we're here to do today is bolster the family financial situation, figuring out ways to do that. So let's take a look at what is going on with our families. Now, this is the national thing from Pew. In 1960, 73% of families were in had two parents in the first marriage. That has declined and has been replaced by single-parent households and cohabitating parents. Now, closer to home, if you want to look at the Atlanta region, and this is kind of the 10-county area, looking at slightly different data, but the same trends apply. In 1970, 13% of households with kids were headed by a single parent, either dad or mom. Today, that's 34%. So why am I talking about that? Well, that's a huge factor in our finances. And this is just simple math. Two couple households make more money than one person households, right? And so, but the difference is pretty stark. And so this, it's not the only factor that's contributing to this, but it is a major factor, just that, you know, we're the definitions of the nuclear family don't really apply anymore, and it does have an impact on finances, especially in the South, where we already have kind of struggling areas. So what this is looking at, this is a map of the nation. Reds represent the highest concentration of households with net worth less than $15,000. So this is isn't income. This is just net worth. And you'll see. Oh goodness. You'll see in the South and Appalachia, we already have some of the highest rates of poorly resourced households. Add in these other kind of structural changes, and you'll see that, you know, we have some challenges ahead of us. Now, just a little fun with maps. I told you I like maps. I told you I was going to throw maps at you. So here are two maps. I know they're not identical, but you can kind of see some similarities, some patterns, right? One of them is the percent of children in poverty, and the other one is the percent of single-parent families. Again, not identical, but you'll do see, you know, some similarities between the two. Now let's do this again. Again, two maps, not identical, but pretty darn close. A lot of similarities between the two. One of them is food stamp recipients, and the other was children with no parent in the labor force. And so again, this gets back to the ideas. Looking at lots and lots of data can really help fill in a cohesive story about what's happening. And getting to that cohesive story is important for us to make the right decisions. Okay. Now, socioeconomic trends. One of the big things, and this is related to, really, a lot of this is related to the changing demographics, is just the state labor force participation rate. So this is forecast into the future, into 2040. We're going from about a 68% participation rate to a 59% participation rate. I know that doesn't sound a lot, but that's actually a pretty large structural change. And a lot of this is driven by simple demographics. So you'll see the white labor force participation rate is actually really dipping below. Then you'll have the black participation rate, other races including Asian, and then Hispanic. So you'll see that the white labor force participation rate, the decline of that is really pulling it down. And I just got a 5-minute warning, so I gotta go. This is employment forecasts. You'll see in 1990, we had manufacturing and retail were the biggest sectors. And that manufacturing one in particular was important because that was really the bolstering of the middle class. And you'll see since 1990, the growth of that has been negative. So we've actually lost manufacturing jobs. And by 2040, the healthcare sector, again, reflecting the changing demographics, the healthcare sector is going to be the biggest sector in the economy. Now, before we get ahead of ourselves, let's look at what's been happening recently here. Well, this is just the forecast for the state. Again, metropolitan areas are going to be adding the most jobs. In terms of Georgia, again, the job markets are recovering nicely. We rank 5th in the nation in the number of total jobs added over the past year. That's a good thing. Georgia has finally caught back up to the nation in terms of annual growth. You'll see that recession was particularly deep here in Georgia. But the income is not keeping up. Now, Georgia is a low cost of living state, so we can get away with this, with lower incomes. But you'll see in 1996, we had closed that gap to about 1900. But by 2012, that gap is back up to 7400. So it's, I mean, you know, and what that means is the per capita income is lower today than it was in 2000. And there's a lot going on with the, so if you look at the demand for labor, this isn't jobs, this isn't actual jobs, this is what employers are seeking. Georgia ranks 21st in the nation in the number of total job postings per capita, so that's ranking in the middle of the pack. But the types of those jobs, again, this is this mix of old economy, new economy jobs. You have truck drivers, number one, software developers, number two. So it is that mix of old economy and new economy. But the problem is about 58% of those postings require a bachelor's degree. Only about 29% of the population has at least a bachelor's degree in Georgia. So it's that huge gap, and so it's the front lines, it's the battlegrounds that I'm talking about of trying to, you know, align, you know, vocational education, high school education, technical colleges with the reality that, you know, more and more jobs are seeking bachelor's degrees. And again, if you look at this, the people who are winning, it is the most educated. So this is a complicated chart. I didn't make this. This is actually the Andrew Young School of Policy Studies. So this is looking at employment growth for the college educated, those with at least a bachelor's degree. This quadrant up here, just imagine that there's, you know, big letters up there that's actually telling what these are. Just fill in the blanks. Essentially, what this means is this quadrant up here is employment growth in high-wage jobs, employment loss in high-wage jobs, employment loss in low-wage jobs, employment gains in low-wage jobs. Okay? And so this is for the college educators. So you see a lot of bubbles in that quadrant that we really like. Okay? Now, for those with just some college, you don't see anything in that desired quadrant. You do see a lot of job growth, though, which is, you know, job growth, all job growth is good job growth, but it's really in the lower wage sectors. And then finally, those without a high school, you don't see anything up there. And actually, you see a lot of just straight up job losses in these low income sectors. So what's going on? That's the scatter of where the most educated live. But really what's going on is if you look at, and this is metropolitan Atlanta, if you look at, and I've separated into high-wage, mid-wage, and low-wage occupations, and this is just job change since 2010, you'll see some growth in the high-wage occupations, a lot of growth in low-wage occupations, but not much in the middle. Okay, and so this is just job growth. Now, looking at wage growth, only things that have added that have a higher wage today than in 2010 are these high-wage occupations. And you see just a veritable bloodbath in the middle range. And so is this just in a metropolitan Atlanta thing? So let's look at that. So we're going to compare Atlanta to other metropolitan areas. This is growth in low-income occupations. You see that, yeah, we have a lot of growth in low-income occupations, but so does Charlotte and Dallas and Houston. So maybe it's not just an Atlanta thing. This is just kind of a national thing. But then you look at the growth in mid-wage occupations. Almost nothing in Atlanta. So maybe this is just an Atlanta thing. And then finally, growth in high-income occupations. Yeah, an 11.2% growth is good, but it's still being dwarfed by others. So there is something going on, in particular, to metropolitan Atlanta. And this is my final slide, so Melissa's glaring at me. Get off the stage. So this is just a simple doing the math, okay? So this is what the average family spends in metropolitan Atlanta, okay? It's roughly $49,000. Okay, this is what they spend, and this is what they spend it on, housing, transportation, food, you know, just the basic needs. Now, if you're a family of three, so two-parent family with one kid, and you're at the poverty line, that's what you get, okay? And, you know, this is using averages, all right? So, yes, you may be able to take care of your housing needs, but who knows if you're going to be living anywhere close to where you work. Or close to where your child can get a good education. None of that is factored in here. And even if you double that line, you're still not all the way up. And I know the other makes it sound like, okay, that must be some good stuff. No, that's stuff like education. That's stuff like books. And so, you know, when we talk about creating an economy for all, these are the things that we need to be thinking about. And so I really appreciate you letting me speak to you guys today. And I don't know if I've taken all the time that I have, or can we take some questions? Okay. But thank you. I have answered every
ready for
single
question?
Question.
Anybody have a question? Great.
Neil does. Right. I'll give a link to it. And I'll give it to one of these guys, and they'll blast it out.
Do you have a question?
Mm-hmm. Mike, the political implications of the growth of the non-white sector and then the education levels of the non-white sector, particularly poor, and the employment or income levels of the non-white sector. So we got the growth that we want, maybe, in terms of people, but are we... what's happening in the education levels of those people, and what is the forecast of that, and how competitive can we be in view of that?
I mean that's the question du jour. I mean, we don't know. Now, what we do know is, like, you look at the educational attainment of some of the foreign-born groups. When you start looking at first generation versus second generation, so take the Hispanic population, for example. A lot of them moved here after high school age. And so you'll see a lot of the Hispanic population without a high school diploma. Well, they moved here after the age. But now their kids are in school. And so let's get into second and third generation families and see what their educational attainments are like. My guess is that they'll become more in line with everything else. And that may be, you know, that may be go a long way in answering your question. But in terms of forecasting what it is, that's why we have to, you know, do the best that we can today, because we don't really know what's going to happen with that. Now, this is a tough question. Does anybody have a better answer than that? Feel free to. I'm struggling here. Okay. Any more?
How are same-sex couples factored into your analysis?
Those are classified as other families, along with single parent, are also classified as other families. So they're all kind of lumped in together. Probably for the last year, they'll probably actually have a separate category the next census.
Thank you. I loved all your maps.
Oh, good. There's one.
What I was trying to understand what you were saying about the loss of the middle income sector, and I didn't know, you know, what kind of sense to make of that.
There's been so much talk about that in the last year about, you know, the middle income jobs and what's happening to it, and we don't have a good answer for that. I mean, we know it's happening, but why it's happening, it's a lot of that, it's that alignment of, I guess, educational expectations, vocational training. There's a lot to this, especially in the workforce development space. A lot of employers are asking for bachelor's degrees for jobs that don't necessarily require bachelor's degrees. There's just a lot of things that, a lot of discussions that have to happen to better align our resources, which is our, you know, our workforce, with, you know, both new economy jobs and old economy jobs. And, you know, that's happening, but, you know, it hasn't happened yet.
Were you able to look at, or what do you know about voter registration and voter participation in across those populations?
I wish I had good data on that. It kind of mirrors the same thing that you're looking. I mean, the same thing that you already know. I mean, voter registration, voter participation are lower in the non-white populations than they are in the white populations, lower in the younger populations than they are in the older populations. And remember that the older populations tend to be majority white, the younger populations tend to be majority non-white. And so it's, I mean, that's what we know, but in terms of neighborhood by neighborhood look, that'll be that would be fascinating to look at.
I also like the maps. Didn't understand all of them, but I do like them. They were pretty. is some of the growth in Georgia from people moving here from other states the ones that decreased? And if so, considering the economic status of Georgia, what is bringing people here?
Okay. That's a great question. And so when we were one of the fastest growing regions really in the world, between like the Olympics, 1996, up into the Great Recession, we imported a lot of people. A lot of people from specifically California, New York, New Jersey. You know, pretty high cost of living places. And so the idea, at least the narrative is that we were attracting these people because of our low cost of living. So in California, back when the housing market was hot, you know, you could sell your house there for, I don't know, pick a number, $500,000. Move here, get the same house for $150,000. And you're pocketing just a load of cash. And so it made economic sense. And so population growth begets employment growth. And so we were importing a lot of talent, taking these jobs. And so for a while there, Metro Atlanta was booming because we had that cycle going. And then when the Great Recession hit, everything stopped. And that really means that now we have to think about how do we grow native talent, because we may not be able to import talent forever. I mean, we're adding population again. But a lot of it is from, you know, not just other states, but from other countries. And so that presents its own challenges in terms of, you know, filling that pipeline with workers into jobs. Did that answer, did I sufficiently skirt your question?
Love the slides, as always. Mike, and to connect with Tim's presentation, where we're getting a little bit into upcoming legislative session here in Georgia, tax policy, you slipped in early on when you started off the whole issue of growing income inequity. Mm-hmm. We didn't see a slide of where is the economic divide kind of growing, or any comment on that?
Because I think absolutely.
We've been hearing recently, for example, Gwinnett County, where we're having, as you pointed out, some of the most dramatic changes in poverty rate and stuff also is reported at one point to have the largest economic divide growth in all of America per county. Or so say a little bit about the economic divide.
Yeah, I mean, if I had 3 hours, I could include everything. Not even 3 hours. I'd need more than that. But what he's talking about is, you know, metropolitan Atlanta and city of Atlanta in particular is the most income unequal place in America. So to say that in actual English, it has the highest levels of income inequality. And as a lot of that is due because, you know, especially if you look in the city of Atlanta, you know, you'll have the Buckhead neighborhoods and then you'll have the Southwest Atlanta neighborhoods. Some of the richest neighborhoods in America are in Buckhead, and some of the poorest neighborhoods are in America are also in Atlanta. And so that's what he's talking about. And there's also been other studies showing that the chances of a kid born in the lowest quintile of income has about a 4% chance of rising to the highest income bracket, which is among the lowest mobility rates in America. And so that also gets back to that middle, just the kind of the loss of the middle income jobs. And I think this is all part and parcel. It's all connected. I say this over and over again. It's all related to one another. If you see the middle class, middle income jobs leaving, big growth in the high income jobs, big growth in low income jobs, nothing in the middle, that's going to exacerbate the issue that Rob's talking about with income inequality.
Got time for a couple more questions before we get our first panel up on stage. Here's...
In K-12 education, especially high school, mm-hmm. there's a big push at all levels of the state for technical education. And I've heard so many people say, if you get a welding certificate, you can start at $50,000, be making more than people with a college degree. I'm wondering, both in terms of technological development, robotics, and in terms of just, is that a blip? Is it true? I mean, I want to make sure they're not being sold a bill of goods, which is what happened in the past.
I mean, there's better experts in the room than me. But what I hear a lot is, yes, I hear the same narrative, like, you know, welders, you know, there's a high demand for welders, high demand for truck drivers. A lot of it is, you know, it is structural in nature. So think about truck driving jobs. They still pay a good salary, but now the people who are programming the routing, those are the ones that are making the big money. Those are the ones in high demand, too. And so that's pushing up, you know, their wages and stagnating the wages of the truck drivers. Now, another part of this is if you look at, again, it's just what employers are seeking. So like software developers, for example, 90% of those jobs require a bachelor's degree. Now, do you really need a bachelor's degree to be a coder? No. And so a lot of it is these discussions we have to have with both employers, technical colleges, high schools, about, you know, what are we really seeking? So the reason the employers ask for a bachelor's degree for coders is because they want to make sure that they have good communication and good writing skills. Right? And the bachelor's degree is a proxy for that. But it's these discussions that we're having, that lots of people are having, about these alignments that need to occur so we can better address that question.
Thank you.
Sure, thank you.
My question really dovetails in on the previous question. And a disclaimer, I do work at a technical college. And my concern in talking about a lot of the jobs that are requiring bachelors is that that's not what we're seeing. That's not what we're being told, so to speak, by a lot of our employers. And it's not just the commercial truck driving jobs. Mm-hmm. With the governor having now identified 12 industries, or 11, that are strategic industries that are high wage, high income, and most of those can be prepared, the people can be prepared with a 2-year degree or less. We're not saying don't go on to get a bachelor's, master's, or PhD, but certainly we find that a lot of people don't go for the 4-year because they can't see themselves getting past 2 years. So that's a start. And I'd just like to know, I know you're the expert on demographics and whatever, but I did want more discussion around that too, rather than just leaving us with the idea again that people are asking for bachelor's, because that's not what we're seeing.
Well, yeah, I mean, you look at the demand side that I showed, you know, truck drivers are the number one in demand, and you can go down that list and you'll find lots of other occupations that don't require a bachelor's degree. They're not even asking for a bachelor's degree. So there are lots of those jobs. It's just a question of, like you're saying, alignment, getting kids into that technical track. And, you know, I don't have the answer to that. You would know a lot better than I would about that. Oh, thank you. Thank you for bringing that up. Anything else? Okay. So it is time for, I'm told that y'all get a break now. Y'all deserve it.